Gulf War Syndrome. After Sodom obtained a stockpile of the brucellosis, it was discovered that this contagious designer bacteria had mutated and become airborne. And it was too late. According to the Scots, Sodom used his toxins on American troops during the Persian Gulf War. This attack by mycoplasma, exacerbated by the impaired immunization systems caused by untested vaccines, the depleted uranium used in anti-tank shells, and oil well fires, combined in a toxic mixture resulting in the illness known as Gulf War Syndrome. Researchers could only look dumbly on when 100,000 veterans returned from the Gulf War presenting all of the brucellosis symptoms, and the Pentagon could only take up the tried and tested myth that the veterans were not really sick at all. They only imagined they were, the Scots explained. Troops initially were told that no such infection existed and that the problem was mostly in their minds. But over the years, authorities were forced to admit that something had triggered severe illness in many Gulf War veterans. Curiously, French troops who served in the Gulf War did not receive the same mix of vaccines as the British and Americans and did not suffer from Gulf War syndrome. Apparently, their undamaged immunization systems were able to withstand the mycoplasma attack. A 1993 staff report to Senator Donald W. Regal Jr. entitled Gulf War Syndrome, the Case for Multiple Origin Mixed Chemical/Biotoxin Warfare Related Disorders, contrasts the relationship between the high rate of Gulf War illnesses among troops exposed to direct agent attacks and the much lower rates among those exposed only to the indirect fallout from coalition bombings of Iraqi chemical, biological, and nuclear targets. Because the U.S. military was not likely to reveal one of its most secret biochemical weapons or face liability by admitting that it had been sold to Saddam Hussein, the report concluded that vaccines were to blame for the troops' illnesses. However, the report also hinted at the possibility of other causes, stating, while other possible causes of the Gulf War syndrome, such as petrochemical poisoning, depleted uranium exposure, and regionally prevalent diseases, have been discussed, no other explanation proves as compelling. Although Regal's report was completed in September 1993, it was not made available until April 1997, when the American Gulf War Veterans Association was finally able to obtain a copy. Not only were service members being forced to take untested vaccines, many veterans were not receiving adequate medical care due to missing medical records. The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee Report, 10397, issued on December 8, 1994, showed that the military medical records of 51% of 150 Gulf War veterans surveyed were either missing or inaccurate. Clearly, something other than mere negligence must have been at play if so many medical records were missing or inaccurate. In 2009, Gulf War infection due to man-made mycoplasma seemed to be repeating itself. In mid-August, three Canadian soldiers were quarantined at a hospital in Quebec City, Canada, after returning from Kandahar, Afghanistan. The soldiers were infected with a drug-resistant superbug formerly titled Acinetobacter baumannii, but dubbed by the American troops Iraqibacter. Fearing they too may have contracted this bug, two civilian patients who were in contact with the soldiers were also isolated. This isn't the first case we've had. We've received military patients returning from Afghanistan with this bacterium since 2007, said a hospital spokesperson. In a 2007 report, Wound Care Canada wrote that incidences of this strain have increased in U.S. military hospitals. America's CDC has issued a report stating that an increase of Acinetobacter baumannii in military hospitals treating U.S. troops serving in Iraq, Kuwait, and Afghanistan was noticed as far back as 2002. Following the Gulf War and the misrepresentations of the government, the mycoplasma spread to the civilian population, whereupon many people began suffering from debilitation and tiredness. Once it was known that the contagion was spreading into the general population, top officials with the National Institutes of Health and Centers for Disease Control, as well as the Defense Department and the Department of Health and Human Resources, claimed the disease was connected to the Epstein-Barr virus. They labeled it chronic mononucleosis, and it has now become known as chronic fatigue syndrome, or CFS. Like the veterans before them, victims of this ailment initially were told it was merely a psychological condition. Yet, by 2010, the CDC had acknowledged CFS as a long-term debilitating and complex disorder characterized by profound fatigue that is not improved by bed rest and that may be worsened by physical or mental activity. The CDC estimated more than 1 million people in the United States are affected by the syndrome, and that there are tens of millions of people with similar fatiguing illnesses who do not fully meet the strict research definition of CFS. One victim, Dr. Martin Lerner of William Beaumont Hospital, told his peers in the American Society of Microbiology that the mysterious disease left his heart damaged and that he suspected that CFS was caused by viral infection. Lerner, who founded the Treatment Center for Chronic Fatigue Syndrome in Beverly Hills, Michigan, created the Energy Index Point Score in hopes it would become a standard measurement tool to evaluate the degree of disability for CFS patients. Lerner has connected the Epstein-Barr virus, human herpes virus 6, and cytomegalovirus and similar infections to CFS. These are the very debilitating diseases studied by Donald and William Scott, who concluded that the victims of such neurodegenerative and systemic diseases are ill with a very real physical disease deriving from a subviral particle developed from the brucellosis bacterial toxin. The idea that a man-made biological weapon may be responsible for the ill health of millions of Americans is horrifying enough. Is it possible that such a catastrophic circumstance is the result of a conscious plan by the globalists? Depopulation efforts. Researchers now believe that virtually everyone in North America, and perhaps the world, carries the crystalline pathogen, although no symptoms will become apparent until the latter stages of some serious disease. Many conspiracy theorists believe in early 2009 that something within the swine flu vaccinations would trigger the pathogen. Swine flu, officially a new strain of the H1N1 influenza virus, was first identified in the spring of 2009 following an outbreak in Mexico. Oddly, although the strain contains a combination of genes from swine, avian, or bird, and human influenza viruses, it cannot be spread by eating pork or pork products, leading many suspicious persons to suspect that swine flu is of human manufacture. Some theorists also believe that the spread of the health-destroying mycoplasma toxin fits in well with the agenda of the wealthy elite who have long supported eugenics and have been looking for ways to cull the human herd of useless eaters. Many cite a classified study made by the U.S. National Security Council under Henry Kissinger in 1974, entitled National Security Study Memorandum, NSSM 200, Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests. This study, also known as the Kissinger Report, stated that population growth in the so-called lesser developed countries, or LDCs, represented a serious threat to U.S. national security. The study was adopted as official policy in November 1975 by unelected President Gerald R. Ford. In a 1981 interview concerning overpopulation, former ambassador to South Vietnam and chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Maxwell Taylor, after advocating population reduction through limited wars, disease, and starvation, blithely concluded, "I have already written off more than a billion people. These people are in places in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. We can't save them. The population crisis and the food supply question dictate that we should not even try. It's a waste of time." As if he were reading from Taylor's script, England's Prince Philip was quoted in People magazine as saying, "Human population growth is probably the single most serious long-term threat to survival. We're in for a major disaster if it isn't curbed, not just for the natural world, but for the human world. The more people there are, the more resources they'll consume, the more pollution they'll create, the more fighting they will do. We have no option. If it isn't controlled voluntarily, it will be controlled involuntarily by an increase in disease, starvation, and war." Years later, Philip mused, "In the event that I am reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation." In the early 1970s, Associate Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg may have echoed the views of Ivy League intellectuals when she said she believed the Roe v. Wade abortion decision was predicated on the Supreme Court majority's desire to diminish populations that we don't want to have too many of. She added that it was her expectation that the right to abortion created in Roe was going to be then set up for Medicaid funding for abortion. Where did Ginsburg get the idea that American policymaking elites were interested in decreasing undesirable populations? Some researchers suggested that Ginsburg, at some point, became acquainted with the writings of John Holdren, or of like-minded people in the most militant branch of the population control movement. In 1977, Holdren was a young academic who helped antinatalist guru Paul Ehrlich and his wife Anne write Ecoscience, Population, Resources, Environment. Holdren's work states, "If some individuals contribute to general social deterioration by overproducing children, and if the need is compelling, they can, could be required by law to exercise reproductive responsibility, just as they can be required to exercise responsibility in their resource consumption patterns." Expressing the desire for a planetary regime by controlling all human economic activity and interactions with the environment, the authors suggested the power to enforce the agreed limits on population growth by whatever means necessary. This includes involuntary sterilization, abortion, or even mass involuntary sterilization through the infiltration of sterilizing agents into public water supplies. Internet blogger and radio host William Norman Grigg pointed out that amid the Obama administration's effort to impose centralized universal health care, John Holdren sits as Barack Obama's science czar, in which he counsels the president on the role of science in public policy. This relationship has a certain strange Lovian undercurrent, given Holdren's enthusiasm for eugenicist and totalitarian methods of population management, he noted. Prolific author G. Edward Griffin, best known for his book on the Federal Reserve, The Creature from Jekyll Island, also voiced concerns over Holdren's thoughts on martial law and depopulation. Noting Holdren's advocacy of forced abortions and putting sterilization chemicals in the water supply, Griffin stated that Holdren discussed the possibility of reducing the population by insidious means. He was not concerned with the ethical or freedom issues involved with these measures, only their practicality. Now we find this same man, an academic expert on population reduction, at the right hand of the President of the United States, advocating mass vaccination against the swine flu using vaccines that half of the medical profession believes are unsafe. Remember, all of those who hold power in the governments of the world today are collectivists, self-styled globalists, and the guiding rule of collectivism is that individuals and minorities must be sacrificed if necessary for the greater good of the state or of society. Of course, those who rule will decide what the greater good is and who is to be sacrificed, Griffin said. This, of course, is the basic problem with population control. The idea of limiting the burgeoning Earth population is probably desirable, as the increasing number of humans as well as their waste is placed a strain on the planet. The rub comes with the question of who will decide which segments of the population must forego childbearing for the good of the majority. So far, it is the wealthy elite, the globalists, who have taken the lead in creating ways of holding down population growth through eugenics, drugs, and birth control measures. Former Assistant Secretary of Housing Catherine Austin Fitz agreed with Griffin that one of the globalists' goals is depopulation. Perhaps it is the goal of a swine flu epidemic as well, whether biowarfare or hype around a flu season, she warned. I keep remembering my sense of urgency leaving the Bush administration in 1991. We had to do something to turn around the economy and gather real assets behind retirement plans and the social safety net. If not, Americans could find themselves deeply out on a limb. I felt my family and friends were in danger. They did not share my concern. They had a deep faith in the system. As my efforts to find ways of re-engineering government investment in communities failed to win political support, Washington and Wall Street moved forward with a debt bubble and globalization that was horrifying in its implications for humanity. Overwhelmed by what was happening, I estimated the end result. My simple calculations guessed that we were going to achieve economic sustainability on Earth by depopulating down to a population of approximately 500 million people from our then current global population of 6 billion. By 2009, 7.7 billion. I was used to looking at numbers from a very high level. To me, we had to have radical change in how we governed resources or depopulate. It was a mathematical result. Fitz noted that some government budget analysts have concluded that the nation can no longer afford previously assumed social safety nets like Social Security and Medicare. That is, unless you change the actuarial assumptions in the budget, like life expectancy, she said. Lowering immune systems and increasing toxicity levels combined with poor food, water, and terrorizing stress will help do the trick. A plague can so frighten and help control people that they will accept the end of their current benefits and the resulting implications to life expectancy without objection. And a plague with proper planning can be highly profitable. Whatever the truth of what swine flu is or vaccines rushed into production without proper testing and peer review, it is a way to keep control in a situation that is quickly shifting out of control. Manufactured AIDS. Adding to fears over conscious efforts to involuntarily reduce the human population are growing concerns that some killer plagues are man-made. To this day, many citizens still believe that acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS, was created by bioengineers working in the United States after the immigration of Nazi eugenicists. It was in 1983 that AIDS was publicly recognized as a deadly and rapidly spreading disease, when the CDC called AIDS a peculiar biological curiosity among New York City homosexuals. Suspicion grew around the world that AIDS was the product of germ warfare experiments designed to destroy undesirables. One theory was that it developed between 1969 and 1972 in U.S. laboratories, then released in Africa by unsuspecting WHO workers in 1975 in doses of the smallpox vaccine. It was believed by some that AIDS came to the United States in 1978 in hepatitis B vaccine laced with human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. Don't discount conspiracy theories on origins of AIDS, stated a headline in Kenya's newspaper, The Daily Nation. In a December 2009 article, it was noted that 33 million persons worldwide and 13 million sub-Saharan Africans have died of AIDS. Writer Angeo Kalambuka noted, soon after the U.S. State Department published the Global 2000 report for the president in 1980, advising that the world population must be reduced by 2 billion people by the year 2000, Thomas Ferguson of the Office of Population Affairs elaborated in the Executive International Review that the quickest way to reduce population is through famine, like Africa, or through disease, like in the Black Death. Population reduction is now our primary policy objective. The belief that AIDS was manufactured by the United States is supported by a record of hearings before a subcommittee of the House Committee on Appropriations in 1969. In his testimony to the subcommittee in 1969, Dr. D. M. MacArthur, Deputy Director for Research and Technology at the Department of Defense, said, "Within the next 5 to 10 years, it would probably be possible to make a new infective microorganism which could differ in certain important aspects from any known disease-causing organisms. Most important of these is that it might be refractory to the immunological and therapeutic processes upon which we depend to maintain our relative freedom from infectious disease." In other words, he meant a type of germ that would neutralize the normal human immunization system. MacArthur told the congressman that tentative plans for the development of this organism had already been drawn up between the Pentagon and the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council, and that the project would cost $10 million. Interestingly, MacArthur admitted that such a program was highly controversial, and that there were many who believe such research should not be undertaken lest it lead to yet another method of massive killing of large populations. Mycoplasmas will forever be at the heart of the U.S. biological warfare program, stated Attorney Boyd Graves, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and director of AIDS Concerns for the Common Cause Medical Research Foundation in Ontario, Canada. Graves had produced a timeline flowchart that correlated more than 20,000 scientific papers and 15 years of progress reports concerning a secret federal virus development program, which he claimed proves the man-made origins of AIDS. The 1971 flowchart makes it perfectly clear and provides absolute evidence of the United States' intent to kill its own citizens and others, declared Graves. Graves told one interviewer, "No one in the U.S. government has downloaded the 1971 flowchart. There is a substantial basis in the U.S. law and fact for the allegation and the conclusion that the United States intentionally made HIV/AIDS with the purpose for use as a population control weapon, a quiet and silent holocaust of people of color toward the development of a new world order." The depopulation views of Maxwell Taylor, Henry Kissinger, and others are echoes of the words from a 1996 full-page ad by Negative Population Growth Incorporated, NPG, that was published in Foreign Affairs, the official publication of the Council on Foreign Relations. "We need a smaller population in order to halt the destruction of our environment and to create an economy that will be sustainable over the very long term. We are trying to address our steadily worsening environmental problems without coming to grips with their root cause, overpopulation. All efforts to save our environment will ultimately be futile unless we not only halt U.S. population growth, but reverse it so that our population can eventually be stabilized at a sustainable level, far lower than it is today." According to the ad by NGP, the population level being sought by the globalists was described as a U.S. population in the range of 125 to 150 million, or about its size in the 1940s. According to U.S. Census statistics in mid-2009, the population stood at 307,229,513. Thus, more than half the current population needs to disappear to reach the level envisioned by the globalists. Such globalist thinking continues today. On May 5, 2009, some of America's leading billionaires met in a private Manhattan home just a week before the annual meeting of the secretive Bilderbergers in Greece. Calling themselves the Good Club, attendees included Bill Gates, David Rockefeller Jr., Warren Buffett, George Soros, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Ted Turner, and Oprah Winfrey. According to John Harlow of the Sunday Times, the group agreed with Gates that human overpopulation was a priority concern. Another guest said that there was nothing as crude as a vote, but a consensus emerged that they would back a strategy in which population growth would be tackled as a potentially disastrous environmental, social, and industrial threat, wrote Harlow. So to achieve the globalists' dream of a U.S. population of no more than 150 million, the current population would have to be halved. What's to happen to more than 150 million Americans? Apparently, those with great wealth and power have decided to take overpopulation into their own hands. And these individuals were connected to the same families and corporations that funded communism in Russia and then National Socialism in pre-war Germany. Today, with AIDS, mad cow disease, chronic fatigue, and the rest, history is apparently repeating, noted Dr. Len Horowitz. In fact, even the message is the same. The millions of Holocaust victims were told they were going into showers for public health and disinfection. That's why we are being told to get vaccinated. Virtually nothing has changed, not even the message. As an indication that nothing has substantially changed in the ruling hierarchy of the globalists, on February 8, 2009, President Barack Obama's National Security Advisor, General James L. Jones, opened a speech to the 45th Munich Conference on Security Policy in Germany by admitting that he takes his daily orders from Dr. Kissinger, filtered down through General Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger. Donald and William Scott believed a high-level agenda to reduce the population went above Henry Kissinger. The Washington corner of the brucellosis triangle, with its military, NIH, Treasury, and Justice Department components, have had their ties to and have largely taken their directions from the New York corner dominated by the Rockefeller interests. And the Rockefeller interests through the agency of the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, the Rockefeller Institute and University, the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Chase Manhattan Bank have constituted a vast machine of power and baleful influence whose parts have meshed together in an effort to maintain that power. Dead microbiologists. One reason why more doctors don't want to look more closely at the mycoplasma pandemic may be that work in the field of microbiology appears to be hazardous to one's health. By mid-2009, nearly 100 scientists around the world had died, many under suspicious circumstances. Most of them were microbiologists. Researcher Mark J. Harper compiled a list of scientists in some way connected to the study of viruses or vaccines. While some of these deaths may be purely coincidental and seem to pose no connection, many of these deaths are highly suspicious and appear not to be random acts of violence. Many are just plain murders, commented Harper. While not everyone on this list died an unnatural death, the sheer number and scope is breathtaking. With this many dead, couldn't this mean that someone, somewhere, wants to get rid of those who see through the conspiracy of fraudulent pandemics and might produce effective antidotes? A full list of these names and dates of death can be found on several internet websites, including Mark Halper's site, www.pupstheories.com. That's pups, P-U-P-P-S, theories, one word. Dr. Rife's discovery. Insidiousness of control has become so pervasive that a remarkable scientist was professionally discredited and ruined for claiming to discover a cure for dangerous diseases. Today, Dr. Royal Raymond Rife's suppressed technology is making a worldwide comeback despite the opposition of the medical establishment. In the 1930s, Rife demonstrated the ability of specific radio wave frequencies to disrupt viral and bacterial cells. Every biochemical compound, including single-cell organisms, oscillate with a unique frequency vibration. Because germs are carbon-based life forms, they are susceptible to disruption by radio frequencies. When the amplitude or resonance of the frequency is intensified, the cell can be shattered and destroyed. By increasing the intensity of a frequency, Rife increased the natural oscillations of one-celled bacteria and viruses until they distorted and disintegrated from structural stresses. A crude analogy to this effect is a glass shattering when a singer sounds a high note. Rife's work with pathogens began as a result of his invention of the universal prismatic microscope, which was more effective in studying organisms than electron microscopes because those devices killed specimens by bombarding them with radiant energy. Using specially ground quartz prisms and an elongated microscope tube, Rife not only was able to view live specimens, but also his view was amplified up to 60,000 times. He became the first human to see and photograph live viruses and to note that they evolved and changed form just as other organisms. A 1944 report from the Smithsonian Institution entitled The New Microscope by Dr. R. E. Seidel, report number 3781, stated, "Under the universal microscope, disease organisms, such as those of cancer and other disease, may be observed to succumb when exposed to certain lethal frequencies." This was strong support for claims that Rife's frequency therapy actually worked to destroy diseases. Following decades of research, Rife isolated the frequencies of numerous disease cells, including cancer, and by broadcasting them back to the cells in an intensified form, was able to shatter the original disease cell. This technology does not harm normal healthy cells or tissue. There has not been one documented case of a person harmed by a Rife-type device. In fact, there are narratives of many successes. A special research committee of the University of Southern California confirmed that Rife frequencies were reversing many ailments, including cancer. By 1934, Rife had isolated a virus that incited cancer cells and stopped it by bombarding it with radio frequencies. He was successful in killing both carcinoma and sarcoma cancers in more than 400 tests on animals, and in using his frequencies to cure 16 cancer patients diagnosed as terminal by conventional medicine. Soon enough, the established medical community realized that this device would not only wreck the pharmaceutical industry, but damage medical practices in general. Cures meant fewer visits to the doctor. Opposition immediately came from Dr. Thomas Rivers of the Rockefeller Institute, who had not even seen Rife's equipment in operation. Rivers claimed evolved forms of viruses did not exist. Conflict broke out between those persons who had seen viruses changing into different forms beneath Rife's microscopes and those who had not. Because his microscope did not reveal them, Rivers argued that there was no logical basis for belief in this theory, evolving forms of viruses, explained national radio commentator Jeff Rentz. The same argument is used today in evaluating many other alternative medical treatments. If there is no precedent, then it must not be valid. Nothing can convince a closed mind. Most had never actually looked through the San Diego microscopes of Rife. Air travel in the 1930s was uncomfortable, primitive, and rather risky. So, the debate about the life cycle of viruses was resolved in favor of those who never saw it. Even modern electron microscopes show frozen images, not the life cycle of viruses in process. Overworked and underfunded, Rife and his associates were easy targets for attack. The health authorities made false claims against him, altered his test procedures so that his demonstrations would fail, and made impossible demands on him. In 1934, Rife declined an offer to partner with Morris Fishbein, then head of the American Medical Association. We may never know the exact terms of this offer, but we do know the terms of the offer Fishbein made to Harry Hoxsey for control of his herbal cancer remedy, reported Rentz. Fishbein's associates would receive all profits for 9 years, and Hoxsey would receive nothing. Then, if they were satisfied that it worked, Hoxsey would begin to receive 10% of the profits. Hoxie decided that he would rather continue to make all the profits himself. When Hoxie turned Fishbein down, Fishbein used his immensely powerful political connections to have Hoxie arrested 125 times in a period of 16 months. The charges, based on practicing medicine without a license, were always thrown out of court. But the harassment drove Hoxie insane. Rife's troubles turned more serious. His lab was ransacked on several occasions, but no suspect was ever caught. He was also harassed by health officials. Baseless and costly lawsuits were brought against him, resulting in his bankruptcy. The suits, some filed by persons with connections to pharmaceutical corporations, ultimately failed. The USC's Special Research Committee was disbanded. Rife was marginalized, and his device today is available only as a costly research instrument employed by a few doctors and private citizens. Rife died a broken man in 1971. Although Rife's work has been confirmed by scientists and researchers outside the United States, the conventional medical community still ignores the benefits of this technology and continues to prosecute those who do. Those Americans who have confirmed or endorsed various areas of Rife's work include Dr. Edward C. Rosenau, Sr., former chief of bacteriology at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Arthur I. Kendall of Northwestern Medical School, Dr. George Dock of the Los Angeles County Medical Association Library, Dr. Alvin Ford, professor of pathology at the University of Southern California, Rufus Kleinschmidt, president of USC, Dr. Milbank Johnson, director of the Southern California AMA, Waylon Morrison, chief surgeon for the Santa Fe Railway, Dr. George Fisher of Children's Hospital, New York, Carl Meyer with the Hooper Foundation, and many others. Barry Lines, a California investigative reporter, learned of the Rife story through John Crane, who had worked at Rife's side from 1950 until Rife's death in 1971. Initially skeptical of the claims of the healing benefits of Rife technology, after studying the documentation held by Crane, Lines became outraged by the injustices that had wrecked Rife's life's work. Lines' 1987 book on Rife and his work, entitled The Cancer Cure That Worked, 50 Years of Suppression, became an underground favorite and sparked renewed interest in Rife's work. Starting in 1995, San Diego manufacturer James Folsom marketed and distributed Rife-type devices when he took over the Royal Rife Research Society. He claimed to have hundreds of testimonials that his devices improved physical symptoms and in many cases led to remission in cancer. According to Folsom, he had no dissatisfied customers. Folsom was raided by the FDA in 2003 during Operation Cure-All, a campaign that targeted various companies in the alternative health market. Although Folsom's equipment was confiscated, Folsom heard no more about it for years. But then, in October 2007, just days before his vulnerability would have ended under a statute of limitations, Folsom was arrested and charged with several felonies, including selling a Class 3 medical instrument without a license. Folsom argued he did not need a license because his equipment was a Class 1 biofeedback device. These devices were exempt and had been used for more than 70 years with no known harm or side effects. Regardless, the FDA claimed these biofeedback devices were under its jurisdiction over medical devices under a 1976 law. That law allowed for the prosecution of selling high-voltage medical devices. However, it should be noted that Folsom's machine at that time could be powered by a 9-volt battery. Despite being offered a plea bargain that would allow him to plead guilty to a misdemeanor and make him pay a $250 fine and suffer 1 year of unsupervised probation, Folsom decided to go to trial. According to U.S. Attorney Karen Hewitt, Folsom's business generated more than $8 million in revenue over its years in operation. Assistant U.S. Attorney Melanie Pearson said the case was the largest involving illegal medical devices that she had seen in 20 years working as a prosecutor in San Diego County. The trial was held in U.S. District Court, where no discussion of the effectiveness of Rife's technology was allowed. Originally, Folsom wanted to produce stacks of testimonials from satisfied customers, but Melanie Pearson objected. Folsom then tried to assert that for more than 70 years, no harmful effects had been documented from the devices. This, too, was not allowed. Folsom then tried to argue that none of his customers had been dissatisfied, but to no effect. Aside from prosecutors and government officials, the only witnesses at the trial were 24 of Folsom's friends and fellow device distributors. They unanimously testified to Folsom's good character and clean business practices. Incredibly, the prosecution used this testimony against Folsom, claiming that, in fact, Folsom was such a brilliant fraud that even his peers and customers weren't aware they'd been defrauded. Prosecutors claimed Folsom used the false name Jim Anderson to avoid being caught by the FDA, and that he gave buyers the false impression that the FDA had approved the devices for investigational purposes. Folsom admitted he had used the name as a salesman at a different company, but had used his real name on all official government correspondence. In February 2009, a U.S. federal jury in San Diego convicted Folsom of 26 felony counts for selling Rife devices under the name of Naturetronics, AstroPulse, BioSolutions, Energy Wellness, and Global Wellness. Folsom, 68, faced more than 140 years in prison, literally a life sentence at his age, and $500,000 in fines. He is being held in the federal government's Western Region Detention Facility in San Diego, now managed by the private firm Geo Group Incorporated. A few weeks after Folsom's trial and conviction, the FDA issued a news release announcing that manufacturers of 25 types of medical devices marketed prior to 1976 must submit safety and effectiveness information to the agency so that it may evaluate the risk level for each device type. Supporters of Folsom said the FDA's decision to scrutinize such pre-existing technology was most likely the result of his trial. One Folsom supporter stated, "Jim stood on his principles for his innocence and to clear the Rife name. It was an impossible task. Jim was up against an endless supply of money through the FDA and an unjust system. Research has found since Jim's conviction that our judicial system is more of a money machine than Big Pharma and the medical industrial complex." Observers saw Folsom's conviction as a blow against those supporting Rife technology. They also predicted that those interested in the technology would have to go to foreign websites, such as www.rife.de. Rife is spelled R-I-F-E, a site in Germany where the sales and use of Rife-type devices are legal. With the FDA seeking to require prescriptions for everyday vitamins and suppressing potentially useful medical technologies like Rife's, not to mention the new government-controlled national health care plan, it would appear as though there is a conscious effort to prevent the public from acquiring healthful alternatives to chemical drugs. But why would the government harm us with untested vaccines and the suppression of potentially healthful therapies? Wouldn't such actions also adversely affect the health of the global elite? Some researchers believe the answers may be that the inner core globalists already utilize such technology or something even more advanced. Is it possible they can cure themselves of the same illnesses they allow to be inflicted on others? The globalist elites may not be worried that their eugenics plans will touch their families. They may believe they can protect their own DNA with race-specific pathogens. If they should contract some dire affliction, might they easily eliminate it with just a few short hours of frequency technology or advanced antidotes for immunization, therapies cloaked from the general population? The possibility of holding such publicly denied therapies that might end disease and halt or regress the aging process would prove a most effective enticement in the recruitment of minions to aid in the advancement of their globalist agendas. Drugging the population. There will be, in the next generation or so, a pharmacological method of making people love their servitude and producing dictatorship without tears, so to speak, producing a kind of painless concentration camp for entire societies. so that people will in fact have their liberties taken away from them, but will rather enjoy it, because they will be distracted from any desire to rebel by propaganda or brainwashing, or brainwashing enhanced by pharmacological methods. And this seems to be the final revolution. Aldous Huxley, 1961. Big Farm. Drugs are big business. Only five biopharmaceutical companies, Novartis, GlaxoSmithKline, MedImmune, the Australian firm CSL, and Sanofi Pasteur, have been awarded massive contracts by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, to develop and produce more than 195 million doses of swine flu vaccine. This is in addition to the seasonal flu vaccine. According to Dr. Joseph Mercola, an osteopathic physician and author of 16 books on health and alternative medicine, including two New York Times bestsellers, CSL has contracts to supply $180 million worth of bulk antigen to the U.S. MedImmune will supply 40 million doses of its live attenuated nasal spray swine flu vaccine for more than $450 million. And Sanofi Pasteur is providing more than 100 million doses of monovalent swine flu vaccine, a $690 million order. About half of the world's largest pharmaceutical corporations are not American, but rather European. Among the top 10 pharmaceutical companies are the American companies Pfizer, Merck, Johnson & Johnson, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and Wyeth, formerly American Home Products. The rest of the top pharmaceutical companies are the British companies GlaxoSmithKline and AstraZeneca, the Swiss companies Novartis and Roche, and the French company Aventis, which in 2004 merged with another French company, Sanofi Synthelabo, putting it in third place. These corporations essentially function alike, but their drug prices in America are much higher than in other nations' markets. For example, a bottle of 1,000 aspirin costs less in Mexico than a bottle of 500 across the border in the United States. And obviously, no company will sell a product without making a profit. To give some indication of the money involved in the modern drug business, the legal pharmaceutical market totaled $712 billion globally in 2007, of which about $80 billion was for psychiatric drugs. According to several authorities, including Harvard psychiatrist Dr. Peter R. Breggin, Bruce Wiseman, national president of the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, geneticist Dr. Thomas Roeder, Dr. Hyla Kass, a former assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA School of Medicine, and David Healy and David B. Menkes, both of the North Wales Department of Psychological Medicine, psychiatric drugs may be the culprit behind many homicides, suicides, and school shootings. Even worse, the $80 billion doesn't even include the illegal drug market. A former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Marcia Angel, wrote in the New York Review of Books, "The combined profits for the 10 drug companies in the Fortune 500, $35.9 billion, were more than the profits for all the other 490 businesses put together, $33.7 billion. Over the past two decades, the pharmaceutical industry has moved very far from its original high purpose of discovering and producing useful new drugs. Now, primarily a marketing machine to sell drugs of dubious benefit, this industry uses its wealth and power to co-opt every institution that might stand in its way, including the U.S. Congress, the FDA, academic medical centers, and the medical profession itself. In her 2004 book, The Truth About the Drug Companies, How They Deceive Us and What to Do About It, Dr. Angel argues that the current power of the pharmaceutical industry can be directly traced to the industry's phenomenal growth during the Reagan years, with George H.W. Bush and his globalist supporters in command, following Reagan's wounding during an assassination attempt in March 1981. The watershed year was 1980, she noted. Before then, it was a good business, but afterward, it was a stupendous one. From 1960 to 1980, prescription drug sales were fairly static as a percent of U.S. gross domestic product. But from 1980 to 2000, they tripled. Now they stand at more than $200 billion a year. Of the many events that contributed to the industry's great and good fortune, none had to do with the quality of the drugs the companies were selling. The success of Big Pharma has more to do with marketing than with the effectiveness of its drugs. Dr. Michael Wilkes, a professor of medicine and vice dean for medical education at the University of California, Davis, joined other critics in describing a recent phenomenon called disease mongering, an activity in which large drug corporations attempt to convince healthy people they are sick and need drugs in order to boost sales. Most pharmaceutical companies devote huge amounts of money to prevent, control, and cure diseases, he added. When their profits don't match corporate expectations, they invent new diseases to be cured by existing drugs. Countless examples of disease mongering are driven by the pharmaceutical industry's drive to sell drugs, wrote Dr. Wilkes. Conditions such as female sexual dysfunction syndrome, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, toenail fungus, baldness, and social anxiety disorder, aka shyness, are a few places where the medical community has stepped in, thereby turning normal or mild conditions into diseases for which medication is the treatment. Ironically, though Big Pharma invents new diseases, they rarely invent a new drug. Surprisingly, most new and important drugs brought to market in recent years were based on taxpayer-funded research at universities, small biotechnology companies, or the National Institutes of Health, NIH. In fact, most supposedly new drugs are merely a variation of older drugs. If I'm a manufacturer and I can change one molecule and get another 20 years of patent rights and convince physicians to prescribe and consumers to demand the next form of Prilosec or weekly Prozac instead of daily Prozac just as my patent expires, then why would I be spending money on a lot less certain endeavor, which is looking for brand new drugs? Asked Dr. Sharon Levine, Associate Executive Director of the Kaiser Permanente Medical Group. What's true of the 800-pound gorilla is true of the colossus that is the pharmaceutical industry. It is used to doing pretty much what it wants to do, wrote Dr. Marcia Angel. The most important of these laws that relax restrictions on pharmaceutical corporations is known as the Bayh-Dole Act, after its chief sponsors, Senator Birch Bayh, Democrat, Indiana, and Senator Robert Dole, Republican, Kansas. Bayh-Dole enabled universities and small businesses to patent discoveries emanating from research sponsored by the National Institutes of Health, the major distributors of tax dollars for medical research, and then to grant exclusive licenses to drug companies. Until then, taxpayer-financed discoveries were in the public domain, available to any company that wanted to use them. But now, universities, where most NIH-sponsored work is carried out, can patent and license their discoveries and charge royalties. Similar legislation permitted the NIH itself to enter into deals with drug companies that would directly transfer NIH discoveries to the industry. Thus, when a patent held by a university or small biotech company is eventually licensed to a big drug company, all parties cash in on the public investment in research. Under this system, research paid for by public money became a commodity to be sold for profit by privately owned companies. Dr. Angel provides examples of the large consulting fees paid by pharmaceutical corporations to individual faculty members and to NIH scientists and directors. These fees allow for globalist pharmaceutical corporations to further intrude into the nation's medical education. The lucrative connection between Big Pharma and medical schools and hospitals has brought about a definite corporate-friendly atmosphere. One of the results has been a growing pro-industry bias in medical research in both schools and hospitals, exactly where such bias doesn't belong, stated Dr. Angel. She noted that the huge amounts of money flowing from Big Pharma began to change the ethos of medical schools and teaching hospitals. Such nonprofit institutions began to view themselves as partners of industry. Faculty researchers were encouraged to obtain patents on their work, which were then assigned to their universities. The schools then sold the right to Big Pharma and shared in royalties. Many medical schools and teaching hospitals even created technology transfer offices to capitalize on faculty discoveries. Dr. Angel noted the excessive salaries for pharmaceutical executives. Take, for instance, the whopping $74,890,918 salary paid to Charles Heimbold Jr. in 2001, the former chairman and CEO of Bristol-Myers Squibb. This does not count his $76,095,611 worth of unexercised stock options. At the same time, the chairman of Wyeth made $40,521,011 in 2001, not counting his $40,629,459 in stock options.